Red Eye is 3 hours of alternative politics and culture, broadcast live from 9 until noon every Saturday morning on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM in Vancouver, Canada. Here's Lorraine Chisholm.
Prisons in Iraq are filled with innocent Iraqis. The detainees are mostly civilians, rounded up in sweeps and late-night raids. These are ordinary people yanked out of their lives and disappeared into overcrowded pens like Abu Ghraib. Some estimate the numbers as high as 18,000. It includes women and children. In the last 2 weeks, we've been stunned by graphic photographs of brutality, degradation, and torture of these people. Torture, not at the hands of the much-vilified Saddam Hussein, but by American soldiers. The Pentagon admits they have many more horrific photographs. Many are expressing outrage and surprise at the cruel and pornographic nature of the photographs from Abu Ghraib prison. But Robert Jensen says outrage is appropriate, but we should not be surprised. Robert Jensen is the author of Citizens of the Empire, The Struggle to Claim Our Humanity, and the co-author of the book Pornography, The Production and Consumption of Inequality. He teaches media law, ethics, and politics at the University of Texas at Austin, and he's involved in a number of activist groups working against U.S. military and economic domination of the rest of the world. Good morning, Bob.
Good morning. Glad to be with you, Lorraine.
What's your response to your president's attempt to characterize the scandal at Abu Ghraib as the isolated actions of a small group of disreputable soldiers at the lower ranks and his assertion that this behavior doesn't reflect what America is?
Well, that's not surprising. That's what people in power always do when the very predictable abuses of an imperial army take place. This happened in Vietnam. It happens every time you unleash a fighting force in this kind of situation. There will be abuses. It's almost inherent in the process. You take an occupying army with high levels of racism, and you set them loose on a population that has been dehumanized. Well, this is the kind of thing that happens. It's not only that commanders clearly were aware of and approved, it's that there's something much deeper in the nature of empire, I think, that will produce this.
Many of the pictures that came from Abu Ghraib are sexual in nature, showing Iraqi prisoners in demeaning positions and often nude. You've made a connection to the pornography that's consumed all over America. How do you see that connection?
Well, I have, in addition to being part of an anti-war movement, my intellectual and scholarly work has been in the critique of pornography. Contemporary mainstream pornography, I mean the things that are on the shelf in most adult bookstores, that material, which has always been based on the domination of women, has been getting more overtly cruel in the last decade or two. That is, the overt depravity, the degradation of women, the use of and glorification of cruelty is part of the pornographic world, and that is not a small industry. The estimates of revenue in the pornography industry in the U.S. are at about $10 billion, which puts it on a par with the Hollywood box office. So if you live in a culture that is saturated with a very misogynist kind of pornography, is it surprising that soldiers will, you know, recreate that kind of image when they are engaged in the systematic abuse of prisoners? It seems to me to be very, again, very predictable. And by that, I don't want to make light of it or suggest it's somehow not important. We should be outraged, we should be angry, and we should be profoundly, I think, sad about this, what it says about our culture. But I don't think we should be surprised.
I think it's interesting in a way that, one of the things that seems new about this, that there are pictures that are available of this and that people have gone to the work of creating a certain kind of picture, which in a sense is producing pornography.
Right, and that's not new either. I mean, you can look back at wars as long as there's been photography. You can find pictures of soldiers holding up, you know, a body part of an opponent they have killed. There's a lot of really grotesque and gruesome images from the history of warfare. It's simply that now the ease of production and transmission with digital technology means that you can no longer contain this. In the old days, it might have been soldiers who passed these kinds of things around themselves. They didn't really seep out, for the most part, into the larger culture. But it's that technology that makes it possible. That's why it was kind of, in a sort of sick way, funny when Donald Rumsfeld first commenting on all of this, you got the sense he almost just wishes digital cameras had never been invented. In other words, he wasn't, I think, initially outraged about the actual events and the conduct. It was the fact that technology made it impossible to keep it within the family, so to speak, which I think reflects the values of people like Donald Rumsfeld.
Quite a few people have commented that the photos reflect a racist orientation as well, and I think one writer that I read said it reminded him of the pictures of Black Americans who were hung at the hands of lynchers in the early part of the last century. Where do you see the racism fitting in here?
Well, racism is employed by the empire, whether it's the U.S. empire, the French, the British. It's always employed to make the killing of non-white people around the world easier. That is, if you're going to go forward as an imperial army, you are going to destroy people in other parts of the world, and it's quite clear you're doing that as an occupier and as an invader. And how do you make that possible? Well, you have to dehumanize those other people. That's the main strategy of war propaganda. And one of the easiest ways to do that in Europe and the United States is through racism, and it's been used forever. Anytime you want to really take from another people something that doesn't belong to you, the easiest way is to construct them as less than fully human. And I think that's absolutely right. If you look at those lynching photos from the 20th century in the United States, they do have the same kind of feel. There's a glorification of white supremacy in those, and there's kind of a sick feeling you get in your stomach when you look at them. And without question, I think that racism allows American soldiers to do the things they do. It dehumanizes the enemy.
What's your perspective on Bush, for instance, going to the Arab world? And he professes a kind of respect for Islam and for Muslims.
Well, that's because the society has changed. You can no longer talk about brown people as if they are subhuman, as you could in past. So Bush has to mouth a certain kind of rhetoric about respect for Islam or respect for the Arab world, and in a sense it doesn't matter if it's true. Maybe he believes it, maybe he doesn't. The point is that he's engaged in an illegal occupation following an illegal invasion of an Arab country, and he will, like all leaders do, will employ the strategies that make that possible, one of which is racism. And in a sense, his public statements don't really matter. It's the practice in the field that matters. And this, again, is not unusual, and it's certainly not unique to the United States.
I've seen one of the photographs that I saw was of an Iraqi boy giving a, I don't know if you've seen this one, he's giving a thumbs up while he's next to a smiling soldier, and he's carrying a sign that says, "Lieutenant Corporal Bordeaux killed my dad, and then he knocked up my sister."
Mm-hmm.
It's presumably Bordeaux that's standing beside him smiling. How do you explain what some observers have described as the trophy nature of these photographs?
Well, I have seen that photograph, and I assume that the soldier wrote that sign, and that the child didn't know what he was holding up. If he doesn't speak English, he has no idea what sign he's holding. So it's a kind of cruel joke, not only on the child, but in a sense on the whole society that the United States has invaded. And the fact that the dominant society, not just that soldier, I mean, he didn't take that for his own personal enjoyment. He took that to show other people, knowing that they would enjoy it too. Look at these damn Arabs. Look how stupid they are. He knows that kind of picture will be received in his social circles positively, otherwise he wouldn't take it. So it's a reflection, I think, quite frankly, of the depravity of American culture, and I think we have to come to terms and use words like that to describe the moral state of this country. It is, not unique in history to the United States that empire tends to produce a kind of barbarism in the dominant culture, because if you're going to go around the world destroying to concentrate power for yourself, it's going to take a certain sort of perverse psychology to allow you to do that. And I think we have to come to terms with that and call it what it is and not flinch.
Thursday you were on a program, and I understand this came up for discussion, or this is what you were discussing. What was your experience of the public reaction to your discussion on that program?
Well, I've had the privilege, I guess you could say, of being on two right-wing talk shows on cable news channels in the U.S., on MSNBC and on Fox, in the last two nights. I was also on a right-wing radio show in the U.S. yesterday. And what you see is a systematic excusing of American brutality and a playing up of the brutality of the enemy. And from my point of view, that's morally inconsistent. If you want to condemn the beheading of Nick Berg, which you should do because it's a grotesque and indefensible act, you should also condemn the same kinds of actions that are put forward by people on your own side. But all of this right-wing talk machinery is, in fact, geared up to do exactly the opposite. It is to highlight the violence and the immoral kinds of acts that happen from the enemy, and to downplay and excuse away that. So I was on a show, where one of the other guests, a right-wing guest, called the abuses at Abu Ghraib as just forcing people to get naked. That's all it was. So the systematic beatings up to and including the killing of some prisoners, the rape, the sexual humiliation that, you know, goes beyond mere frat party pranks about getting naked, is all reduced to, you know, forcing a few prisoners to get naked, and who can care about that? It's just a little prank. So, again, what that reflects is the complete inability of the United States, the dominant culture in the United States, to hold itself accountable. And it's not just about what happened in the prison. It's about the way we fight wars. At the same time, there's been all this talk about the prison scandal, which there should be. There's been virtually no talk in the United States about the collective punishment that was inflicted upon Fallujah. Hundreds of people dead, most of them civilians. And what was the crime of the people of Fallujah? Well, they rose up against an illegal American occupation. And for that, and for the killing of four American mercenaries, the entire city was subject to a grotesque attack. The United States shut down the hospital in Fallujah, which killed people. It bombed the power plant in Fallujah, and then it started literally just running amok in the city. Well, there was virtually no discussion of that in the United States.
I was interested. You and I were talking yesterday, and you said that the premise of the show, the MSNBC show, was, or maybe it wasn't the premise, but people were saying that the media was anti-war, uh-huh, and that this was kind of proven. This was being kind of proven through this whole discussion, the less attention given to Nick Berg's beheading than to the Abu Ghraib scandal. That just seems utterly ludicrous to anyone who's been fighting this war or thinking critically about the media's role in it.
I would agree completely. But that's the degree to which a very successful propaganda campaign by right-wing forces in the United States over the last two or three decades has pushed this idea that the media are dangerously liberal. They may be even radical, so that anything the media does is already assumed to be liberal and anti-American. So then they can take this situation, in which the Nick Berg story was covered in the United States, I think, in an adequate way. I mean, I saw the story, you know, I read the story in mainstream papers, saw it covered on TV, but this has nothing to do with reality for the right wing. What they do is they pick up on any sort of thread of evidence that they can use to make a claim, no matter how ludicrous the claim is. And then they, because they have the power through this talk radio, through these, you know, radio shows, television shows, they have the power to frame issues in a way that leads to these conclusions, no matter what the evidence is. And that's, you know, it's important to realize that's not, that's a long-term project the right wing has been involved in, at demonizing the media. Now, the media's flaws are evident, and they're not about being too liberal. They're about being too subservient to power, whether that power is conservative and reactionary or moderate or more liberal. That's the fundamental problem of media, is that it doesn't know how to break outside of official structures of power. But this just shows you, I think, the degree to which the political culture in the United States has degraded over the last 30 or 40 years.
Now, we've been hearing conflicting explanations about the systematic torture of Iraqi prisoners. On the one hand, it's described as unacceptable, but apparently many of the techniques are approved by Pentagon lawyers. Where do you think they're coming from with this discussion?
Where is the military coming from?
Yes.
Well, what they're trying to do is avoid the reality, which is that if you're going to fight wars like the United States fights, wars of invasion, of occupation, wars of empire, in other words, the only way you can fight them is brutally. You can't. It's very hard to invade people who are not welcoming you without engaging that. The problem is, of course, is it's a losing strategy. No empire can indefinitely sustain that kind of project. So it's not just the prison abuses. It's the fact, as I said, in Fallujah, everywhere, that the United States routinely employs force that is so beyond any defensible scale. They use weapons like cluster bombs, which are almost universally condemned as outside, you know, any conception of the rules of war. They do that because that's the only way you can, to borrow a term from Vietnam, pacify a population, that is, destroy the population. But it's hard in a contemporary context where there are rules of war, there is international law, there is a sort of more developed moral sensibility than there might have been 100 years ago when the British were doing this or the French were. It's very hard to simply come out and say you are going to brutalize the indigenous population. So you come up with all of this, what are sense sort of rhetorical gymnastics to try and avoid what is obvious. This is inherent in the nature of a militaristic empire.
I wonder whether you think there are ways that people who have been working against the war can take this, you know, really pretty disgusting situation that's been revealed to us, in addition to all the things that Iraq has been subjected to, and use this particular kind of point in time to advance their anti-war work.
Yeah, I think in some ways it's a very depressing time in the United States for left anti-war organizing. You know, we didn't have what it took to stop the war. We haven't been able to end the occupation yet. But at the same time, the disastrous, you know, course of action over the past year has created a lot of skepticism in the American public, and it's a time to mobilize, to pressure, to speak even more, to get out even more. Because I think that the support for the war was always rather thin in much of the American population. That is, there is a segment of the U.S. population that will always support war, no matter what. But for a lot of other people, it was a product of a kind of fear that led to support of the war. And I think that kind of support is always very thin. So it is, I think, a very important moment, and in some ways a very exciting moment for those of us who consider ourselves part of a not just an anti-war movement, but an anti-empire movement, to really force the United States population to fundamentally rethink the way we go forward in the world.
Well, it's been good talking to you this morning, Robert.
Okay. Great to be with you.
Thanks a lot. I've been speaking with Robert Jensen. He teaches at the University of Texas at Austin, and his new book is Citizens of the Empire, The Struggle to Claim Our Humanity, and it's published by City Lights.
You've been listening to a program produced by Red Eye, an alternative media collective which broadcasts every Saturday morning from 9 until noon on Vancouver Cooperative Radio, CFRO 102.7 FM, in Vancouver, Canada.